very special visitor to Philadelphia. My guest is composer and pianist Randy Weston. Weston grew up in Brooklyn, inspired and influenced by great pianists like Thelonious Monk, Art Tatum, and Duke Ellington. Critics and musicians began reckoning with Weston in the late 50s and early 60s. He recorded as a sideman with musicians like Johnny Griffin, Kenny Dorham, Art Blakey, and Coleman Hawkins. He also became known as a composer after writing such tunes as High Fly and Little Niles. Weston performed at a festival in Nigeria in 1961. From then on, he became a frequent visitor to, and finally a part-time and then full-time resident of Africa. For about 6 years, he lived in Tangiers, Morocco. He now lives in Europe. Tonight, he plays a rare Philadelphia concert. This concert will be in St. Mary's Church, which is on 3916 Locust Walk on the Penn Campus. The concert's at 8. Before we meet Randy Weston, let's listen to one of his compositions. Both his music and the titles that he's given to his compositions reflect his African influences from an album called Blues to Africa. This is a piece called African Village, Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Thank you.
heard Randy Weston at the piano playing his own composition, African Village Bedford Stuyvesant, from an album called Blues to Africa on the Arista label. Randy Weston is my guest on Fresh Air. He's making a rare Philadelphia appearance and will be playing this evening at 8 at St. Mary's Church on the Penn campus. Randy Weston, welcome to Fresh Air and welcome to Philadelphia.
Thank you very much, Terry.
When you first left America to live part-time and I guess then full-time in Africa, it was in the 1960s, and that was a period when it was very difficult for jazz musicians to make it in the States. What are some of the changes that you notice on these return visits to America?
Well, I notice now there's certainly a return to acoustic music, you know, which is really beautiful. It's one of the reasons why I start to come back a lot now. And I think that the younger people, you know, all over the States that I've been traveling, I'm meeting young people who are putting on shows and whatnot, you know. And I think that our audience is very young now, which is really, really beautiful, because in the 60s we lost young people, you know. And so I feel there's really a new energy and a tremendous interest in the music today.
You mentioned acoustic music. You were quoted somewhere as saying that electric pianos to you sounded like robots or sound effects from Star Wars. Do you still feel that way?
Of course.
Okay. Was moving to Africa for you like going home, or did you experience it as a foreign culture?
Oh, no, it was going home. Absolutely.
What was it about the country that made you, who grew up in Brooklyn, New York, feel like you were home when you were there?
Well, because my father, who's very much alive today, he's 85 years old. When I was a little boy, he gave me two things. He gave me African history, and he gave me music. And the two went hand in hand. And so from the time I was very little, I've always had a desire to go back to Africa so we could see our ancestral home. And also to understand myself better, to understand my family better, and also understand the music that I play.
Had your father lived in Africa?
No, he hadn't. No, my father's from Panama. But he's very much in tune with Africa and African culture. And he pointed out to me that everything we do comes from Africa. Our way of speech, our way of cooking food, our way of performing music, our way of dancing is all out of African civilization, you see. And it's when African civilization came in contact with European civilization that all these things, that this music came out. But the key is Africa. So even if there was a tremendous amount of work in the 60s, I still would have gone to Africa.
How was your music met by Africans when you started playing there? Were you already known when you moved there, musically?
No, I don't think I was necessarily known. I had made a few recordings. The first piece I wrote about Africa, first composition, was a song called Zulu in 1955. I had met African musicians in the States and had a tremendous interest in African traditional music. And when I first went in 1961, I went along with a cultural package of 29 artists, which included Nina Simone and Langston Hughes and Brock Peters, Jeffrey Holder, Booker Evan, Ahmed Abdul-Malik. And we went to see what the relationship was between the African culture in the United States and the African culture in Nigeria. And we had also two jazz dancers, Al Mims and Leon James. And it was fantastic because we spent 10 days together comparing the music, the dance, the art, the poetry, and things like this, you see. And I discovered that 400 years is nothing in time, you see. And how little we've changed, I've discovered, you see.
What were some of those things that you found very similar between Black American culture and the African culture?
Just about everything. The way we speak, the way we talk, the way we approach life. Our whole concept of spirituality, our religious beliefs, our approach of music.
What felt different to you?
You see, what felt different?
Yeah, what felt
What
like
was
a different
was
culture?
Certainly hearing the traditional languages, you know. I didn't know any African languages per se, so naturally languages were different. I had to live another way. I had to unlearn, you see, because you can grow up in America and you develop certain habits and certain attitudes. And you're educated in a certain way. When you go to Africa, and especially being from New York, you go to Africa, you have to slow down, you see. And also, in addition to that, you are in contact with nature all the time. When I grew up in New York, and I didn't have much contact with nature.
Not in Brooklyn.
Not in Brooklyn or Manhattan. It's usually sidewalks and big buildings and subways and buses and whatnot. So I had to unlearn. And it took me 2 years to do that. It wasn't easy at first.
When you were playing concerts in Africa, what are some of the environments that you'd play in?
All depends on where. You know, if we played in the major cities, we would play in theaters. We play in cultural centers. When I say we, I guess I should speak about 1967 when we did the State Department tour. And I had a group of with Ray Copeland on trumpet and flugelhorn, Clifford Jordan, tenor saxophone. Ed Blackwell was our percussionist, Vishnu Wood on string bass. Chief Bay played African drum, myself at the piano. And my son Azadeen, he was 15 at that time, but he went with me on the trip. And that's where he started to learn his drumming. So it depends on some. When we went to a place like Gabon, for example, we had to go into the country. We had to go into areas where there are no pianos. So I had to play an electric piano, you see, to get the message across.
In this country, it's only recently that jazz musicians, I think, have been able to, when they wanted to, get out of a club atmosphere and into a performance atmosphere where you're not competing at all with alcoholic beverages being served or with a lot of nightclub chatter happening underneath your playing. Has jazz music in Africa gotten into the clubs? Is there that kind of club scene that exists there?
Well, when you speak about Africa, that's a lot of territory.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
It's a lot of territory to speak about Africa, which is kind of impossible for me to do. I can speak about my particular experiences. And we had our own club in Morocco. We formed a club ourselves. In the club that we had traditional musicians performing. We had music from Jamaica. We had steel bands occasionally. We'd have singers from the Congo. We would have a jukebox. We would have a disco thing where we'd have Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder. And myself and my son would perform with a dancer, you see. So when we were in Morocco, that was the place, you know, for the music. Most other places that I perform, I never saw many clubs because, for example, in West Africa, it's more the high life. High life is a very popular music for dance. And musicians in West Africa, they perform the high life music, but at the same time, you can play jazz licks or you can improvise with the high life beat.
Well, here it's been, it's been recently in the 70s and now in the 80s that there's been, for instance, public radio stations to play a lot of jazz, since most of the commercial jazz stations ended up not being able to sustain themselves. And it's difficult, unless you have access to a public radio station, to hear jazz on the radio. And there's always been a division in this country between what's called pop music and what's called jazz and what's called classical music. Did you face those same kinds of divisions in Tangiers?
Not really, because I went to Africa to listen to the traditional music. That's why I went there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I wanted to understand the music that preceded Europe and preceded the music that I play. So when I went to Africa, I wasn't interested in the music of the cities, actually. I spent most of my time in the country listening to the traditional music and recording and documenting.
What are some of the ways that traditional music has affected your music?
Well, it's made me understand, first of all, what the purpose of a musician is. You see, it's the first thing I had to understand, because you can go to school, you can go to conservatory, and you can study harmony, you can study theory, you can play notes, you can be an excellent musician, technically, and I don't know the reason why you're here, you see. So I had to learn that from the older musicians. They told me what the reason, what the purpose of a musician was in ancient Africa, when Africa was the civilization and the purpose of a musician. The musician had certain purposes. He would play music of every type. He would play religious music. He'd play music for games. He would play music for certain ceremonies. He would settle wars between two different groups. The musicians would be the ones that would be the people who would create the peace. The musician also is music. He should never lie. The musician is also the historian. And the musician is also the ones that projects the future, you see. And also, in many parts of Africa, the traditional musicians, before they even touch their instrument, they speak to God before they do that, you see. So I had to learn these things, because we are following the same, wherever you find African people, you see, whatever music you call it, whether you call it jazz or blues or bossa nova, whatever title you give it, we all follow the same laws, the same spiritual laws, improvisation, polyrhythms, falsetto, different sounds we create, you know. So I found that we found exactly the same laws as traditional Africa. So I guess what I'm saying in essence is that by going back and listening to the traditional music, I understand better the spirituals, the gospels, and the music that I play myself.
Has this affected the way you do a presentation when you're giving a concert?
No, not necessarily a presentation, but the way I approach the music. Yes, it does.
Do you feel that traditional music has affected your approach to rhythm or harmony when you're playing?
Let's say it's a combination of rhythm and spirituality, you see. I was always amazed at, for example, a singer such as Mahalia Jackson, or a singer such as Billie Holiday, or a tenor saxophonist such as Booker Ervin, or whatnot. In other words, there are certain artists that when they play their music, they hit you emotionally very, very strong. I've heard some artists perform and make you cry, you see. And that's what I wanted to find out more about. You find that in the black church. That's why you find such master musicians as Art Blakey or Thelonious Monk, for example. They performed in the church, which means that they got that background, because when you are in the black church, you are in Africa. You see, you have no connection with European culture whatsoever. You're really in an African setting. So by going back and hearing the people perform the traditional African songs and the songs about God and the songs about life itself, you know, it really just made me understand a lot of things better.
You said your sense of spirituality changed living in Africa. Did your religion change?
No, my religion is music.
So at this point, you don't consider yourself a Christian or a Muslim or...
No, music to me is the highest religion of all. Is music.
How was that idea met with in Africa, since where you were living? Since I imagine for some people, well, I've heard some people like Dollar Brand, for instance, Abdul Ibrahim, say that his music is a manifestation of Allah, which is a very different way of spiritually approaching your music. In other words, the music isn't the spirituality; it's a manifestation of Allah, the way he expresses it.
Whatever title you want to give. The creator, because we have many words for the creator. But without question, the creator is the musician, you see, and we are just instruments, you see. So when I perform, you know, I'm getting messages from, the great musician, you see. So I'm an instrument, and the piano is another instrument.
When I spoke to Max Roach here on this program, he was talking a little bit about some of his trips to Africa. One of the things that he said was that he found it a little difficult to feel like he could fit in with the drumming that was happening there, in the sense that some of the drumming came out of very traditional music, and because of that there was a sense of what kind of rhythm would get played on what kind of occasion. And there was a sense of ritual attached to it. And he felt that that was at times limiting, and that the freedom that was able to be expressed within jazz couldn't always be expressed within traditional music. Did you encounter anything like that yourself?
Well, they have music for everything, you know. I mean, when they perform their music, music can go all night long, and there's a lot of improvisation. There's a lot of it, but it all depends on what you're listening to. You have music of the courts, you have music of history, you have music of games. It all depends on what music you're listening to.
Did you ever try to have a sense of occasion to your music? Is there a certain type of concert that you'll give, or a certain kind of piece that you'll play, depending on the occasion? Whether, I don't know if you've played at any formal occasions or during any rituals, as opposed to giving a straightforward concert. Do you have a sense of using music as ritual within some kind of ceremonial or functional occasion?
No, music is simply a healing force. That's what music is. Music is the sacred art. You know, we can't see it, we can't touch it. You know, it's formless. So therefore, for me, music has always been a healing force. So whether you listen to Louis Armstrong, or you listen to Coleman Hawkins or Lester Young, music, you can express anything. But in particular, African music in the States has produced a lot of joy and a lot of very warmth and healing souls. You see, because when you have a concert, you know, there are many people sitting in that audience who might not never have any reason to have contact with each other. But the force of music brings them all together, and the audience and the music becomes one. So what we're doing, when I perform And this has been my experience by listening to Charlie Parker and all the giants of the music, the men who I learned from, that what is happening is that, that musician, you have a gift from God. God has given you a gift. Now, you have to determine what to do with that gift. But you, we are like doctors, but not really doctors. But our purpose in the world is, I think, is to bring beauty and to help to lift the spirits of people, you see. So when I'm performing my music, this is always what's in my mind, you see. That this is a wonderful, wonderful healing force, music.
Let's listen to one of your recordings, and we'll be listening to Berkshire Blues and your recording of it back from 1965, which is now available on an Arista album called Berkshire Blues. Do you want to say anything about this session or this piece before we hear it?
Well, yeah, I would like to say something about this particular session because it's a session that makes me particularly happy because certainly one of my great idols was the late, great Duke Ellington. And his sister heard me play before Duke did, and she thought that Duke should hear me, and she arranged for me to play a small party after a concert Duke did with the New York Philharmonic. So it was just myself and the bassist, and there were a lot of people around, and I played, you know, and all of a sudden Duke came at the other end of the room, and you could feel his force, you know, looking over in direction of the music, and he looked at me, and I looked at him, and he gave me a signal, which a musician can understand from one musician to another, that the music was good. Then he had his sister contact me, and he said he wanted to record me. So originally, this album was supposed to have been a series of pianists that Duke Ellington wanted to record, but the company never got off the ground. And eventually his sister sold the album to Arista Freedom.
It's an interesting story. From this album, we'll hear Berkshire Blues, my guest Randy Weston at the piano.
Thank you.
Randy Weston has recorded in 1965, playing his own piece, The Berkshire Blues. When you started playing, in your early recordings, you can hear the strong influences from other musicians, like Thelonious Monk is, I guess, someone who I hear strongly in your early playing. How did you find your own style? How did you use the people who inspired you the most and emerge into a style that was very distinctly your own?
I don't really know. I never planned any such thing, you know. I'd been very content to sound like one of the musicians that I like. But I guess, you know, with music, you just keep gathering vibrations and notes, information, listen, you know. And I guess there were so many musicians that I loved, you know, and I had a talent myself, which I didn't know about. Even before I met Monk, I always had a very rhythmic approach to the piano, in a way. When I first heard him play, then he opened the door for me. And then when I heard African traditional music, and then when I heard, I was even influenced by Coleman Hawkins, who was a saxophonist, you know. And listening to Gillespie, and listening to Chano Pozo, listening to the spirituals in the church, listening to the calypso music, you know. So all these elements, they just sort of grow on you. And something comes out, but it's not anything planned. It's to plan, I'm going to make my own style. No, it didn't happen that way at all.
You grew up in Brooklyn, and there were, let's see, who were some of your contemporaries in Brooklyn at the time? Max Roach?
Max Roach, Cecil Payne, Duke Jordan, Jimmy Nottingham, Ray Copeland, Ernie Henry, Harold Cumberbatch, saxophonist, Leonard Hawkins, a tremendous trumpet player. Pete Brown lived in Brooklyn. The great saxophonist, Eddie Hayward, lived right across the street from me, Lem Davis. Oh, I could go on and on and on.
Was there a community of Brooklyn players at that time?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, because many people who came to New York came to live in Brooklyn, besides those who were born in Brooklyn, because Brooklyn had more of a residential way of life. It wasn't as noisy or as crowded as Manhattan. So we had a lot of fantastic Brooklyn musicians. And at that time, even Miles Davis was living in Brooklyn. George Russell was living in Brooklyn. Freddie Hubbard, Cedar Walton, Bobby Timmons. I could go on and on and on. So we had a tremendous amount of musicians in Brooklyn.
So would you get together with one another informally outside of clubs to play? Or
you mean at that time?
At that time, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Because at that time, there were no discos. And it was live music everywhere. You could go into certain ballrooms in Brooklyn at 11 o'clock in the day. And there would be a big band rehearsal going on.
Did you ever play with big bands?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have. I've made recordings with big bands also.
When you were young?
Yes, coming up, yes.
Is that a good experience?
Very good, the best.
Do you wonder about the absence of that now for musicians who are coming into their own?
During the World War II, when they put the 20% tax on dancing, and then dance and the music separated. But when Charlie Parker and Dizzy and Billy Eckstein's band, Art Blakey, they always play for dancers.
What's this tax you're talking about? I'm not aware of this.
Yeah, it was a 20% tax during the Second World War, you see. It was a way of raising more money on places of dancing. So what happened, a lot of ballrooms shut down, and the music and the dance got separated because the purpose of the big band was for dance, you see. So at that time, Art Blakey had a big band, and Dizzy had a big band, and Billy Eckstein had a big band, and you would go and hear these fantastic musicians and dance to the music, you see. But after that tax that took place, the dance and music never came back together again. And suddenly people got the impression that you couldn't dance to modern music.
Do people ever dance to your music?
Sure. I dance to my music.
Do you?
Yes. Well, I play it. My right foot is always going up and down.
Do you consider a compliment to your music when people get up and move?
Of course. Absolutely.
People always said that, people say now that bop wasn't danceable.
That's all it was.
It was danceable.
Of course. Absolutely, because in the Savoy Ballroom, for example, when the orchestra would come in with new music, they always had the best dancers to create a dance to go with the music.
Right.
You see, and that's how the dance steps were created. So there was never any separation between the music and the dance because they go hand in hand.
It's an interesting point. People feel that if the dances that you know don't fit to the music, well, what are you going to do unless someone does come up with a dance? I guess no one has come up with any dances appropriate to...
Well, because the ballrooms are not there anymore. Mm-hmm. All the key ballrooms like the Savoy, the Renaissance, these were key places where everybody came to hear the music. Whether it was Chick Webb's band or Count Basie or Ellington or Cab Calloway or who's ever been at that time. So everybody would go to the ballrooms, not only listen to the musicians, but also dance to the music. So that's how I grew up with the music. Concerts were rare.
Another kind of dancing music that you played was rhythm and blues when you were young. I believe you played with a few rhythm and blues bands.
Yes, I did.
I guess a lot of jazz musicians did that. Was that a strong connection for you? Did you get stuff for your music from having played in the rhythm and blues bands?
Of course, because the blues is the whole thing, the blues. That's still the most fantastic thing about our music is the blues. No matter how technically we get, but it's still the blues. That's the essence of our music.
I guess audiences must have reacted really differently.
Yeah, in those kinds wonderfully. Of wonderfully, because during that period, your critics were the audience, not magazines or journalists. No, your critics were the audience, and you had to perform and perform well.
I keep using the word jazz, but I know that that's not a word you use to apply to your own music. Why do you avoid the term jazz?
I don't avoid it.
I mean, why do you not use it?
Because it's not the name of my music.
What would you describe as being jazz at this point?
Well, I don't know. You know, the word jazz is a word that I felt very seldom I've heard musicians use the word. It's a word used by everybody but musicians. I never heard Ellington use the word, never heard Monk use the word, or Dizzy, you see. So we've always been very frustrated because we don't quite know what the word jazz means, and it's a term that describes our music. We can't wipe it out completely because people, jazz festival, jazz is. But I guess for me, jazz has a certain kind of connotation for me. For example, that if you have a jazz magazine or a jazz critic or a jazz club, you know, you're always rated in a so-called jazz atmosphere, you see, when I feel our music has no limitations. And with my own music, which I've incorporated the music of Africa, the music of the United States, you know, the black Americans, from the spirituals, the gospel, to the music of the Caribbean. For me, the title of what I call my music is African Rhythms, because everything I perform is coming out of Africa and coming out of African rhythms.
Randy Weston, I'd like to listen to what is probably, I think, your best-known composition, which is High Fly, from a recording that you made, I guess it was in the early 1960s. Can you tell us a little bit about what was going through your mind when you wrote High Fly, with which a number of other many other musicians have since recorded?
Well, you know, as a boy, when I was 12 years old, I was 6 foot tall, you know. And in those days...
And you haven't gotten any shorter.
I was a giant. I was really very, very tall.
Yeah.
Okay? So when you're very tall, people always tell jokes, you know. They're always making comments because you're tall, you know. Nobody makes comments because you're little. But they always make comments because you're tall, how's the weather, all that kind of stuff, you know.
Wait, let me correct you. People do, I know firsthand, people do make comments when you're little.
Not as much.
No?
I don't think so. Because as a tall person, I never make a comment to a person because they're little. It just never occurs to me to do that, you know. Because nature is so fantastic. It's created all these improvisations of humanity. And we're short and we're little, we're fat, we're et cetera, et cetera. Anyhow, getting back to High Fly. So I wanted to write a song about how it felt to be my height and look down at the ground. So High Fly is a very funny melody. It's a funny song, you know. And that was the meaning of High Fly.
Okay, well, let's hear this recording of High Fly, which has been reissued. It's from, I guess it's from the late 1950s. Let me correct that. This is Randy Weston at the piano, his own composition, High Fly. Thank you. Randy Weston's composition, High Flyers, recorded in 1959. Randy Weston at the piano, Kenny Dorham on trumpet. We heard Coleman Hawkins on tenor. That was Roy Haynes on drums. The arrangement was by Melba Liston. You lived in Africa for full-time for about 5-6 years, I guess.
6 years, yes.
And you told me for the past few years you've been based in Europe.
Yes.
What did you make that change?
Well, I think it was time for me to come out, you know. I didn't, you know, these things that happen, they're not necessarily my own decision, you know. But I think when you play music, music sort of takes you with it, you know. Things happen at certain times. You yourself don't know why. But I think when I left, I think it was just time for me to leave Africa for a while and come out and perform. Plus, I had never performed Europe before. My first time to play in Europe was 1974, when many of the musicians that I had worked with had been performing in Europe since the 50s. So I think it was that right time for me to come out and play.
Did you experience any culture shock?
No. Mm-mm.
How is your music being received?
Tremendously. That's where I started playing solo piano, was in Europe.
Some musicians have told me that in European countries, you have to move sometimes because if you're in one spot for too long, people can start to take you for granted. And, of course, when you get to someplace, people are so incredibly excited by your presence. Do you find that to be true at all?
I think that's true everywhere.
Sure, it's true. Everybody feels that they're taken for granted in their home city. Not everybody, but a lot of people.
Yeah, not necessarily taken for granted, but I think a musician, I think you have to travel. It's no good to stay in one place too long.
You do a lot of traveling.
Yes, I do now.
Do you have a place that you call home in Europe?
Well, my home is inside of me. That's my home. I work out of France, you know. I'm at a very small town in the Alps. But, you know, home is your suitcase, and home is inside. When you're a musician, you become nomadic.
Yes. Some people find that a very difficult life, but you sound like you enjoy it a lot.
Yes, because the real success in life for me is to be able to play music. That's the real success, you see. So whatever else happens is just part of it, you see.
Well, I wish you the best of travels.
Thank you.
And thank you very much for coming to Fresh Air this afternoon. It's been a great experience to meet you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Terry.
I've been speaking with Randy Weston, who is a pianist and composer who's in Philadelphia, and that's an unusual thing to say. He doesn't come here very often, so it's a rare opportunity to hear him play this evening. If you want to hear this concert, it's at the St. Mary's Parish Hall on the Penn Campus at 3916 Locust Walk. The concert begins at 8 o'clock. We're going to listen now to another selection from the album Blues to Africa. This is another Randy Weston piece called The Call.
Thank you.
are contained in his new book, which is called Three Farms, Making Milk, Meat, and Money from the American Soil, and the book is published by Little Brown and Company. Mark, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks very much, Terry.
Can you give us a little profile of the three farms that you lived on?
Well, one of the reviewers in the very nice review in the Times said that they were the farms of the past, present, and future, but I don't really think that's right, because in a way, the slickest, most successful manager is the manager and owner and operator of the 50-cow dairy in Massachusetts. That's the first of the three farms in Three Farms. The man has just won the distinction of being Dairyman of the Year in Massachusetts. They persist in that title even though there are four female dairy farmers in Massachusetts. He farms impeccably. He never makes a mistake. I had to remind myself not to think of him as a sort of Zen master of agriculture. His guiding principle was always, what's the payoff? How can I make this decision so as to make things? I watched him once putting up fence in the spring, and I noticed the economy of his moves, rocking one way with some tools in hand, his hand, the other way with fence posts in his hand. And I mentioned that to him, and he said to me, I'm not ambitious enough to make mistakes. The second farm that I wrote about is a little bigger, 500 acres. I know that sounds pretty big, but by today's standards, that's a cozy family operation. It's in Iowa, in the drier southwestern part of Iowa, steep rolling farmland. Joe Weishar and wife Mary Jane and a couple of kids farm this land. They only own 150 of those acres. The rest of the land is rented, and they have to share whatever they make from that with the landlord. And the financial pressures on them, because of that, the fact that they don't own all their land, couldn't possibly afford it at today's high investment prices, forces them into some kinds of farming practices which are potentially dangerous to the soil. They have to rip out fence rows to accommodate the larger machinery. They have to fight very hard to resist demands of landlords to plant continuous corn, they call it out there, corn year after year after year, using herbicides, and that tends to promote very large-scale erosion, which doesn't show up at first because the land in the Midwest is so terribly rich. Third farm that I wrote about, Tajon Agricultural Partners, is part of a 300,000-acre piece of land owned by a company listed on the American Stock Exchange. I don't think that my book interfered with their business too much. I don't think it was particularly designed to, because the stock of that company has gone up about 20 points since the book was published a couple of months ago. I think that's because there's oil on the premises and the oil market is up. But what I wrote about in particular there was a 20,000-acre sub-operation that was organized, attracted investors by offering them tax write-offs, a very complicated financial arrangement. I don't want to take the time here to go into the intricacies of it, but I worked awfully hard to make it interesting while I was describing it in the book, because I believe that if you want to understand what's happening to food in America, you have to understand the sort of nuts and bolts of the mechanics of how things go on. Anyway, these people set out to grow, it's the birth of a smaller corporate farm, this 20,000-acre one, set out to grow 7 or 8,000 acres of grapes and cotton and almonds and all kinds of other row crops. They, besides, they almost got into grave financial difficulty. They pulled it out of the fire, and their operation is closely supervised at this point by representatives of one of their large financial backers, the John Hancock Life Insurance Company. So that may be a farm of the future. But Lee Topman's isn't a farm of the past.
One of the questions you set out to answer is, why are so many small farmers having to sell their farms and become factory workers or just find a different job? What were some of the answers that you found? What are some of those forces that are making it really difficult for family farms to survive?
A good question. Well, all businesses turn out to operate best at something that economists call optimal size. If you you have to use all your workers right and use the state-of-the-art equipment, or else you can't afford to stay in business competing with those who do. It turned an optimal size for farms has grown. It hasn't grown very large, though. So some farmers, say a farmer in New England who milked 10 cows on land that was hemmed in by hills and swamps and small towns, when tractors came around and milking machines, suddenly that same farmer in the same amount of time could raise 30 cows and milk them. He'd be hemmed in by the geographical features, and he'd end up going out of business. And there aren't very many places in the Northeast, especially east of the Hudson River in New England, which can support many more than 30 cows in one spot. You get up to optimal size for a modern dairy, which is 60, 120, 180 cows like that. And you don't find too many farmers left in New England. In my state, Massachusetts, there were 35,000 farmers just before World War II. There are fewer than 4,000 now. But what's happened in the rest of the country is most of the farmland that was farmed is still farmed. There are just many fewer farmers farming it. I think the number right now is that about 160,000 farmers, that's not very many in the whole country, produce over half of the food that we eat. And when you break that out by crop, it turns out that very small numbers of farmers produce some of the things we eat, small enough so they could sit in a room and take a vote on what things should cost next week if they decided to do it. It's an OPEC-type danger. Here's a number, 969 farms in the 74 Ag Census control 56% of all grain-fattened cattle, 985 farms, 42% of all sheep and lambs, 1,100 vegetable farms, 20% of all vegetable cropland.
So most of the farms are owned by large corporate structures?
No, that's not true. It turns out. The trouble with agriculture is not that corporations are taking over the farmland. This optimal size thing that I was talking about, it turns out that if you get much over the larger size that an owner can operate, as soon as the owner gets down off the tractor and disappears into the boardroom, the cost of doing business on the farm goes way up. You have to add layers of management. You can't make the tractors too large because the wheels start to slip over 200-300 horsepower. So you just have to add blocks of the same equipment. You end up with all kinds of labor hiring mechanisms and inventory mechanisms and management and budget mechanisms and dealing with tax people and stockbrokers and all that kind of stuff. On this Tejon Ranch, for example, their break even one year when I was out there on an acre of tomatoes was 24 tons, a small 700 acre, it's not that small, privately owned farm adjacent to it had a break even of 19 tons to the acre. So the great big farms don't do the cheapest business, and the corporations that own a lot of land know that. Frequently they will lease land to a manager and just share in the profits after having tried to farm the other way in the 60s and early 70s.
So people who own farms who have that efficient size that you're talking about to work can be competitive in the market then?
They certainly can be competitive in the market.
What are some of the ways that you think agribusiness is affecting small farmers?
Well, it's affecting the price of food immensely. When you say agribusiness, I'd like to expand our idea of that a little bit. Farmers today are one link in a food supply chain that starts out with input suppliers, you know, tractor manufacturers, chemical companies, all that sort of thing, seed companies. Then there's the farmer assembling a lot of inputs, as these input suppliers will call it, growing food. Does the food then go to the public? Of course not. The food goes very largely to processors, and from the processors to large vendors, supermarket chains frequently, and then to the public. So the farmer frequently is the last free market link in a sort of almost monopolistic chain. I don't mean to imply that farmers, by the way, are safe from these monopolistic influences. That is happening there, but it's not happening so much with big companies taking over the land yet. It's happening when the most aggressive family farmer in a county will end up managing 8 or 10 or 15,000 acres. A dynastic papa will be in the office and his kids will be on all the tractors. And it's very hard to draw that line. The government's had a lot of trouble saying where a family farm leaves off and a corporate farm begins. There are also some nasty trends on the part of some big banking consortia to buy a lot of land as an investment, which would wreak havoc with the prospects for young people getting into farming even more than it is now, and wreak havoc with food prices even more. So far, that hasn't happened very much. It's a constant danger, though. It almost happened a few years ago.
You mentioned in your book the example of the tomato, where tomatoes have become tough and dry and have been bred to be that way because that's the way they endure long truck rides and stay on the shelf for a long time. Is that type of breeding happening with other kinds of produce, as far as you can tell?
Well, whenever we go after lettuce, that's the most obvious other example. There's a great uniformity and frequent loss of quality, unfortunately, in dairy products. They tend to make a uniform level of butter fat in them that isn't always the, you know, you said when we were chatting before about eating food always becomes a time for nostalgia nowadays. Hey, this used to taste wonderful. I think that's frequently an accurate memory. You can still get the good stuff from the small farmers, and I know in many cities, including Philadelphia, there are farmers markets and tailgate markets, and that helps farmers enormously because they can skip all of these steps along the way.
Do you see this as becoming a trend that's going to happen more and more, where increasing proportions will find that the produce we go to buy is being bred for reasons other than our nutrition and our palates?
Well, I think it's a trend whose time has come already. I don't see how things could get much worse than they are, in fact.
How much does that involve with genetic engineering, do you think?
Well, the industrialization of agriculture involves whole packages. There's no point in making a hard tomato until you have a hard, the reason they made a hard tomato is they were trying to breed a tomato where every tomato on the plant would ripen at the same time and where they'd have a fairly uniform size. Once they did that, they could bother to put in the money to develop a machine that would harvest them, because to harvest them by machine is to destroy the plant. And so when you breed for that kind of timeliness, you lose control of flavor. They also bred for thick-walledness, and they also bred for some shipping qualities, and you end up with this deplorable tomato.
If you speak to people on the large farm, the corporate-run farm, about some of the larger issues that we're discussing now, how their breeding is affecting the quality of food that people find around the country and their supermarket shelves.
I can tell you a couple of stories about that. I remember asking an economist, an academic-type economist who sits in an office full-time. He's